Okay, we're going to get started to our next topic on the agenda, which is audit confirmations. Dee Miranda-Gould, who's an associate chief auditor in the office of the chief auditor, will be leading that discussion. So I will go ahead and turn it over to Dee.
Thanks, Jennifer. Before we start our discussion of confirmations, I'd like to introduce Chris David to my left, assistant chief auditor in the office. Confirmation is an important source of the evidence auditors may obtain as part of an audit of a company's financial statements because generally it is presumed that evidence obtained from independent sources outside a company is more reliable than evidence solely from within the company. The auditing standard on confirmation defines confirmation as a direct communication from a third party in response to a request for information. That definition did not contemplate advances in technology, including electronic forms of communication that are available today, for example, electronic mail. Also, auditors may now obtain direct access, also referred to as direct online access, into the electronic records of an audit client's customer, bank, or other confirming party and check the existence and amount of the audit client's balance without the need for interaction with an employee of the customer, bank, or party. Direct access refers to an auditor obtaining a direct link into the electronic records on a read-only basis. To provide direct access to an auditor, a third party would provide a temporary password to the auditor to allow him or her to independently confirm the information held by that third party. An auditor using a client's password or sitting with a client to review electronic records would not constitute direct access the way we are contemplating it in this discussion. In addition to advances in technology, other changes have occurred. Some banks and other businesses have decided that they can no longer dedicate the resources required to handle responses to confirmations and thus have hired third parties to respond on their behalf. This leads me to our first question. Should the definition of confirmation allow for responses other than traditional mailed responses, such as oral confirmation, facsimile, email, responses processed through third-party service providers, and direct access to information held by a third party? Wayne Collins?
Yes. I guess I'll add to that. I mean, it's certainly in this environment, you know, at least Bank of America and I'm sure other financial institutions now are just not responding to confirmations. And that's their process, but they have established another process where an entity, particular entity that we use called Capital Confirmations, does have access to their records, and the issuer's information on their records. Therefore, we have established procedures going to those third parties to get access to it, and that certainly is, in our view, it's as strong as the normal paper confirmation process, and is the best alternative.
Thank you, Joe Carcello.
I would agree with Wayne just to second that. I'm somewhat familiar with the capital confirmation process, and I'm sure there are other competitors as well. And that seems to have a lot of merit, so I would encourage you to continue down that path. But as it relates to some of what you have up there, you have some other specific wording up there beyond what Wayne talked about. To me, the big issue as it relates to all confirmations, whether it's paper or anything else, is knowing who's responding to the confirmation. And again, I refer to some expert witness work I've done, and you do get colored by your experiences, we all do. And in that particular case, there was a problem, major problem with confirmations. And what was happening is the sales people were confirming rather than people in the accounting area. And so the confirmations weren't of a lot of value. So to me, that's a major issue to the auditor, is to get comfortable as to who's responding. As it relates to an oral confirmation, I think that can work as long as it's followed up with something written. Eventually, the problem with relying only on oral is that no written record of the confirmation response exists, could always be denied, could always claim misunderstanding. Phone conversations are prone to a lot of risk, as we all know from our personal life. And then I would suggest that the board think about, as it talks about confirmations, that they think about incentives to respond truthfully. In retailing, often you get vendor rebates, and so those can be receivables. And when you confirm them, you're confirming from a supplier. And so that, in that case, you're their customer. And so their incentives to not make you unhappy are very different than if you're confirming to somebody who buys from you. What are you going to do, not sell to them anymore? And so I think the board needs to think carefully about those incentives to respond truthfully, because I think it affects the quality of the audit evidence.
Thank you. Galen Hansen?
Our firm also uses an outside vendor that, and I think their name has been mentioned, so I won't mention it again the third time. And that seems to be working, but I'm a little bit distressed with the direction that the banking groups are going with this. I won't say anything more than that. As far as oral confirmations, I think an oral confirmation is essentially no confirmation is incompatible with AS3 as far as that documentation standard. And until you do follow up, as Joe just said, I don't think it constitutes a confirmation because of that misunderstanding, because of the things that can be misinterpreted. And so I would I'd kick oral confirmations out of this and basically say that it's no confirmation.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I'd just like to jump in and kind of ask a follow-up to Joe's point. I thought he made a very good point about incentives to respond truthfully. And Joe, just kind of wondering, in connection with your comment, is the suggestion that it should be a consideration by the auditor to consider if they're aware of any incentives, or I guess kind of in connection with your point, what are you thinking auditors should do? You know, it may be difficult to kind of understand that, but certainly I think it is a good point. So just wondering if you could expand on that to help us in our thinking.
Well, I think the language, I could be wrong, but my recollection of when I read this, you did talk about the auditor should consider the ability, the incentive, the willingness of parties to respond and respond truthfully. If my memory is right, you have language in here, so I'm not sure you need additional language. That's not obvious to me that you do. And I'm sure most of the firms would normally think that through carefully. And in those cases where they don't think it through carefully, that's an inspection or an enforcement issue.
Thank you. Arnold Schlender.
Thank you. I would offer that the IAASB recently had a new standard on confirmations. And a number of questions that are addressed here are also addressed in the standard that we produced. For example, what we mentioned about when there is a refusal to allow a confirmation, or it deals with oral confirmations, whether or not, and not without sufficient corroboration, and other issues, and I will not mention that time and again by question, just would point to the existence of that standard. Furthermore, we, in our meeting a couple of weeks ago, decided that it might be helpful if we issue a staff alert just to bring that standard to life, also in light of very recent developments that cast some doubt about the reliability of confirmations. So that would focus even more on how it's working in practice and thereby assist people in applying the standard. And if we can cooperate with the PCAOB in that respect, that would be great, because we, of course, are serving here a similar objective. Thanks.
So just let me clarify. You're suggesting we might consider a practice alert to discuss issues related to audit confirmations?
Well, that's we as IAASB decided to do. So staff will be working on that in cooperation with some experienced practitioners. But if in drafting that alert we could cooperate with the PCAOB, that of course would be quite helpful.
Okay, thank you. Gary Kerber.
Thank you. Two comments. One on oral. I mean, I don't know that oral confirmations never work, but I would certainly, if you were going to stack rank these things in priorities, you'd have it sort of minimalist, very low level of evidence, and sort of only on an emergency type basis, you know, last minute or something followed up. So I wouldn't put too much, you know, stock in it. But I'm actually looking at the last item in there, direct access to information held by a third party. And again, I accept technology can probably allow you to do that, but I would be nervous about having that be an allowable audit procedure, you know, for something important, because you don't necessarily know what you're looking at. If you're the auditor, and let's say you do have access into some vendor's records or some outsourcing records, and you think of, you know, let's say bank accounts. I mean, there might be, you know, one concentration account and 60 clearing accounts. So you're taking it upon yourself to decide, have I identified the right account or accounts, and have I read it correctly? I mean, these things, and it seems to me you're better off having someone respond on behalf of the institution itself, as opposed to you deciding I've interpreted somebody's ledger or trial balance correctly. It, again, a lot of these arrangements are very complicated, scattered through dozens of accounts and ledgers and stuff. I would be very careful about that. Again, I'm not saying it's an inappropriate procedure, but I have doubts about how good it really will be, you know, in the main for most of the time.
Galen Hansen. Oh, Hal Schroeder.
A few weeks ago, we were down here for the new members session, and I recall one of the sessions went into audit deficiencies, things that you all have found on inspections, and I was struck by the fact that audit confirmations, I think, was not, if it wasn't number one, it was number two on the hit list of things most often done wrong. Will this definition or some expanded definition help rectify that? Is this trying to address a specific problem? Could you give a little bit of color in terms of how this matches up with what you're all finding in the field?
The type of inspection findings related to confirmations, things like auditors not following up on exceptions on confirmation responses, or not following up when there's a non-response, there's no response at all. There's also been confirmation where the auditor has relied possibly too much for a particular assertion. So, for example, valuation of investments. Audit confirmations typically are better for existence assertion, maybe for some other things as well, but you know, to a lesser extent for valuation. And so in certain cases, that was a problem. I'm trying to remember some of the others. I think those are some of the biggest issues with confirmations that we've seen in inspections. So the definition itself doesn't address those kinds of exceptions. Possibly some other areas, like how to deal with exceptions, which isn't discussed in this in this SAG briefing paper, but that would address those kinds of issues. Any other? Oh. Joe Carcello.
Yeah, just a quick point to follow up on what Arnold said earlier. If our memory serves me correctly, I haven't looked at this recently, but if memory serves me correctly, a few years ago, the Auditing Standards Board issued a, it wasn't a standard, I forget what they call these things. It was like a practice alert, but I'm not sure they call it that, on confirmations. And I thought it was pretty good. I thought some of their specific suggestions in there were pretty good. So if you haven't looked at that, you might want to look at that.
Thank you. Yeah, it is a practice alert, and we definitely have looked at it. So, and we're definitely keeping it in mind as we're considering this topic. Jim Cox?
One of the other national committees I'm on is the American Bar Association's Corporate Law Committee, and I just thought I'd share an insight with you that something that this causes fits over the last year. We meet every quarter in half-day meetings, and it relates to this question about oral confirmations. And I share the same level of skepticism, if not outright cynicism about it, except for the following, is that there is a pretty well advanced technology now for taking an oral communication and reducing it to written format. And so you may want to think about that. There's oral and then there's oral. What causes us fits about that is the question about notice, which is a big deal for lawyers, okay? And when you get it, and if you get a message on your cell phone, is that notice at that point, or is it when you reduce it down, and what's it mean to be reduced down? And not everybody has the technology because it's fairly expensive. So it's just, you know, adding undoubtedly an insignificant lawyer footnote to this conversation. So.
Thank you.
May I have a follow-up? Oh, I was going to say, may I have a follow-up? But in that, Professor, in that conversation, did they get into discussion of whether it was legal to actually record it and how that varies from state to state?
It does. I mean, you know, our committee has a focus on a statute that's supposed to be a model for other states, and there are some variations, of course, across the states.
Ted White.
Just a quick comment. I don't really have any concerns over the alternative forms of confirmation except for oral. My take on that is that it just introduces too much potential problem and for very little benefit. And I would suggest just a bright line on oral confirmation at this point to prohibit it until such time that maybe there is some clear-cut advanced in technology in the future where you can accept it. But in just stepping back and thinking about it, it doesn't seem that if somebody's able to give an oral confirmation, it's that much harder to give a written one along with it. And I just don't see the benefit in it. And I agree with Joe's comments earlier, too, about the importance of the source probably more important, actually, than how it's transmitted. But the source is also something that's quite important there.
Bob Daisy.
And we would just like to reiterate the points that Arnold raised, that there are a lot of good materials, I think, in the IAASB standard that address this, and it's relatively recent and gone through due process. And some of the answers to the questions as we go through today, I think, are reasonably answered by their draft, and we would encourage consistency to the extent possible, including the definition. Secondly, with respect to the standard, it ought to be clear about some of these points, particularly oral. I don't think we believe that is a confirmation. It is some form of evidence, and you have to evaluate it in terms of evidence quality. And the other point with direct access, I think some of the language now about direct communication is a better issue because when you do that, there is some risk that who you're connecting to isn't the party you think you're connecting to, and therefore I think you'd have to employ a lot of procedures to ensure that you're actually getting it from that party to meet the requirements of what I think a confirmation would be. So one of the concerns about the proposed language might make too broadly open the direct access, because I do think there are a lot of issues related to verifying that other party. Thanks.
Thank you. Joe Casella.
One other thought that I mentioned, thought to mention earlier, proposal doesn't talk at all, unless I missed it, is the importance of evaluating the form that comes back. And here's what I mean by that. My understanding of what most firms do and what we did when I was in practice is the firm had a standard confirmation form that was sent out. And there was at least one prominent case that I'm aware of where what was sent back is what I would call customized letters from each client. It wasn't the firm's confirmation form. And what ended up being confirmed wasn't the balance, but the total revenue transactions during the year. And obviously what needed to have been confirmed was the receivables balance at the end of the year. And again, maybe, you know, in some sense you think, you know, do you even need to say things like this in a standard, because most auditors are going to be, I would hope, very sensitive to that. But you may want to at least consider the issue of what is the implication if the auditor sends out a confirmation form and gets back something that's very different, how he or she should respond to that.
Thank you. Warren Malkus.
Just from a preparer's point of view, I would take exception, or I do take exception, I guess, to the use of oral confirmations, because I think it's a less quality standard to follow, and I think that it makes it more inefficient for both the external auditor and also for the preparer. Other point here on direct access, I think this would go a long ways in increasing the response rate and the quality of confirmations if there you do have give direct access to the auditors, to customers, to banks, to other financial institutions with whom you might have debt with. But to Gary's point, I think there's some training that needs to take place so that there is the proper use of that direct access. Otherwise, it will add to the inefficiency of an audit and also to that of for the preparer.
Thank you. Okay, Galen Hansen. We get that right? Okay.
Do. I just wanted to follow up on Joe, what you're talking about, the non-standard replies. I don't really have too much of an issue with that, because it's third-party evidence that is coming back. As long as you can reconcile that to the receivable balance, in some ways, I think that's another way of getting to the same thing. I would just consider that a reply with comments that you've reconciled, and not necessarily an exception or something that you cannot rely on. But I do agree that something should be considered perhaps in standard when you do get something back that's completely different than what you asked for.
Thank you. Let's move to our next discussion topic. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
This was the challenging part. We actually both had our 10
seconds. How? Sure.
My initial thought was oral confirmations, like most people, it's very problematic. But then I thought back to, situations where you're dealing with, and I had one like this where it was military shipments. You could get oral confirmation, but you could not get written confirmations. I don't know if there's anyone who's got, certain security clearances that could address that issue, but I think there are certain circumstances where you're not going to get anything in writing. And would this, by excluding it, preclude that? So if there was a way to work that into the language where it's permissible in certain circumstances, and maybe that's one illustration of it.
Thank you. Wayne Collins?
I just wanted to supplement what Galen had mentioned, which played off Joe's comment. If you get confirmation back, that's different from what you sent out in terms of what information you got back. I just think the standard could be written that, to assess whether the objectives of your confirmation request were fulfilled by what you got back. If they were not, then you need to do some more work.
Thank you. Any other? Okay. Now let's move to our next discussion topic, the requirement for an auditor to confirm accounts. The current auditing standard includes the presumption that the auditor will request the confirmation of accounts receivable during an audit. The standard further provides that an auditor should consider requesting confirmation of the terms of unusual agreements or transactions, such as bill and hold sales, in addition to the amounts. Other standard setters have differing views on whether auditors should be required to request confirmation of accounts receivable and other items. For example, ISA 505 does not require confirmation of any specific accounts, terms, or transactions. While the Auditing Standards Board of the AICPA has indicated that inclusion of the presumptive requirement to confirm accounts receivable is appropriate. That leads me to my next question. Should the board expand the presumptively mandatory requirement to request confirmation of accounts receivable in AU Section 330 to include confirmation of terms of unusual agreements or transactions and complex or unusual revenue transactions? Tom Taft?
My view on this is if you were to expand the mandatory requirement, you would then invariably need to define what the scope of unusual transactions were. And even under the best circumstances, you'd never be able to contemplate every kind of unusual transaction. Even if you were able to define all of those today, there's going to be new ones tomorrow. I think you've got to leave this to the judgment of the auditor to determine when is it appropriate and necessary to use a confirmation as a means of getting appropriate audit evidence.
Doug Anderson.
Yeah, I've always felt that confirmations are one of many sources of audit evidence. You can get audit evidence through all sorts of different means. And making the presumption that confirmations is one of the very best in every risk scenario is not necessarily true. So I've never been in favor of the presumptively mandatory requirement because it may have no correlation with the risk of what you're looking at. I think a much better guidance approach would be to talk about the value of confirmations, the weaknesses, the pros and cons of what scenarios it works well in and what scenarios it doesn't, but not to have any presumptive mandatory requirement regarding confirmations of receivables or anything else, and leave it up to the judgment of the auditor to decide based on the risk of the engagement, the risk of the specific area, whether confirmations is a good part of the audit evidence they have to gather, or whether there's other types of audit evidence that might be better or more efficient.
Hal Schroeder.
We've actually kicked this one around internally from an investment standpoint. As we were talking about fair value, last week we actually had a conference call with the FASB on this. One of the ideas that was kicked around was a central clearinghouse of some sort where you could actually confirm credit default swaps or other bilateral transactions where there are really only two parties involved. And as I read this, I thought this is an ideal place to expand confirmations. And I agree, Doug, with your comment. There's some places where it just doesn't make sense. There's no risk there. But there are other places where a confirmation, like a credit default swap, would be a tremendous value. A, does the transaction exist? B, do we have the same terms? And C, I would go as far as saying, if it's a zero-sum game, I lose $10 million, you make $10 million, we ought to confirm that that's actually, at least within ballpark, that we're dealing with the same numbers, so that they are the mirror image of us. I know that may be way beyond the scope of this, but I think the board actually ought to very seriously consider the need for this in light of all these types of transactions and the troubles that we've had in the last year or two.
Thank you. Galen Hansen.
I would agree a lot of this is based on judgment. And as you point out, Harold, I mean, there might be some situations where it might be very straightforward to do the confirmation. On the other hand, you have an agreement. Sometimes I wonder whether, why don't we just attach the agreement to the confirmation, mail it to the client or the confirming party and say, do you agree with this? And you've got a written agreement signed by both parties in the file, so how much are you going to get into this definition of what is unusual and the terms and so forth? And I think you have to go back to judgment, so I don't know that you can standardize that.
Thank you. Paul Sobel.
I think I'm just going to add on pretty much to what's been said before. One other thing to consider here, and I like Doug's suggestion about providing guidance on when confirmations are useful versus less so, and also Galen's last suggestion. If you think about it, an accounts receivable balance is quite simple to confirm. You can have almost a clerical person, I suspect this happens frequently, somebody in the clerical capacity looks up in the system at a point in time, what was the balance? Yes, that's right. Confirms back. When you get into more complicated arrangements, I'd be concerned that, again, absent attaching the contract, you may get confirmation that, yes, those terms exist. There may be other terms that have some very significant impact on the accounting that, for whatever reason, you failed to put in the confirmation and then would not be confirmed as such. So, again, I think there is value to the confirmation, but I don't think it should be required because you're not always certain who is responding to that. Again, if a clerical person is responding on a very complex, again, even credit default swap, do they understand the underlying economics and the accounting implications of that credit default swap, or are they just going to go tick, 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 yes, I found those in a contract, good enough?
Thank you. J. Joe Corsello.
Let me respond to what Doug said earlier, because I think you have language in the standard now that allows for that in terms of not sending confirmations. If you look at footnote 7 on page 4, starting with the second paragraph, the auditor can overcome the presumption to request confirmation if accounts receivable are immaterial, or the auditor's combined assessed level of inherent and control risk is low, and the assessed level in conjunction with other evidence is sufficient to reduce audit risk to an acceptably low level. So I think the standard that exists already contemplates not needing to send confirmations. I also think it would be dicey to have a PCAOB standard that would at least be viewed in the eyes of outsiders as a lower level of performance than an ASB standard. And as long as the ASB requires confirmation, I think it puts the PCAOB in a tough position. I also would agree with, Harold said earlier, considering expanding the use of confirmations. I don't know if I would require it. Requiring it's always a bit dicey, but encouraging, particularly as it relates to confirming terms of material revenue transactions near year end, the amount, the order date, the receipt date, to get at cutoff. Cutoff's a big issue with revenue. And right of return provisions, particularly oral, which are very problematic, as we've seen in many frauds. Again, the focus that I'm coming from here is, I think if you talk to most investors, they would say what they care about is fraud, errors that result in material restatements, and clean opinions before a company shortly thereafter goes belly up. We'll talk about going concern this afternoon. And a lot of these frauds, I don't think a typical management wakes up early in the year, say, today's a good day to start a fraud. It happens toward the end of the year when it's obvious they're not going to hit the targets that the analysts have set, and some management's give in to pressure. And we know that in terms of fraud, revenue recognition is the override, by far the most common means of committing fraud. So if you look at transactions close to year end that are involve material revenue transactions and at least consider confirming them, that would probably be a prudent course of action in many cases.
Thanks, Joe, and you're correct. I mean, the standard right now does have the presumption for accounts receivable, and it has the should consider language about unusual and complex transactions. Gary Kapurk.
This is going to probably be building somewhat on some of the other comments about confirming unusual transactions and arrangements and stuff like that. I mean, the way I think it would work in most big companies, I mean, clerical people are going to give the dollars and cents, but they're probably not going to be actually having the contract. I mean, that's going to probably say the legal department or the business development department or the controller's department. So the clerks are not going to be able to confirm these things. I mean, they pay bills as they come in, you know, or they collect cash as it comes in, as the case may be. But you're going to be dealing with an entirely different level of management if you want to start getting into confirming, you know, the salient terms of deals. And if all of a sudden, if an audit requirement came out where the middle management core, the general counsel's core of the country, is all of a sudden got an extra million confirmations coming out a year, you're not... That's a workload issue. It's going to be challenged, I would think, as far as necessity. I think judgment is the right way to do it. I mean, certainly confirming complex and strange arrangements has its place in auditing, but I think to be required, I think, is going one step beyond where it needs to be.
Thank you. Doug Anderson.
And just to follow up on my conversation and kind of respond to Joe's thoughts, in all consideration of what's in a footnote 7, I think it's upside down when the reliance on judgment and focus on risk is buried in footnote 7 and the narrow prescriptive standard is put up in the front. I think the right order of it is focus the auditor on risk, focus the auditor on persuasiveness of audit evidence, and explain how confirmations work. If we want to put in footnote 7 that receivables is a great place to confirm, go ahead. But I would not put in footnote 7, use your judgment, and then put in the primary standard, we're assuming you're going to confirm receivables. That seems upside down. And if the ASB and the AICPA has a different standard, that's fine. I still think the PCAOB should take the best approach and convince the ASB to change their minds.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, let's move to the next question in this area. Should there be a requirement that the auditor should consider requesting confirmation of other items? If so, which items should be included in this requirement? Galen? Hansen?
I'll jump in here. I think whenever you can focus in on a KPI, a key performance indicator, that involves non-financial measures. And in my part of the world, that might be tons in the mining industry or barrels produced. I like to see those things confirmed, and then it ties back into the financial records. So I don't know that that's part of the standard, but I think it's just sort of common sense, and a lot of times you can get to a quicker answer and a more logical and practical answer if you're confirming some of those sorts of metrics.
So, Galen, would you be saying a should consider?
Yes.
Type of requirements appropriate?
Absolutely. Maybe it's patient days. It could be any number of things, and they would be all over the board depending on what industry you're dealing with, but more of an understanding of the business and industry type of approach.
Thank you. Tom Taft?
I wouldn't object to this requirement. However, I would think that in most situations today, auditors are already considering using confirmations as part of the audit process, and thus would question whether it even needs to be an explicit requirement.
Thank you. Hal Schroeder?
This is more of a question. You use the term here, investments. Why would you not be using the more of the financial instruments terminology from the accounting standards?
It's a good question. I mean, we were thinking broadly. Investments was a term we picked, but we could say financial instruments. There's no reason why it couldn't be that. Wayne Collins?
Yeah, I think rather than getting into the particulars of which accounts or areas should be considered specifically, I think the auditor needs to address the assertions that are that he's interested in, he or she is interested in, and what is the persuasive means of obtaining evidence to corroborate the assertions. And if confirmation is the persuasive evidence, then that's what the auditor should use. And certainly areas that are quite often confirmed on audits are certainly cash, marketable securities, accounts payable. I think maybe firms have gotten away from that, but since there's such an acceleration of the filing deadlines to rely on subsequent disbursements to verify accounts payable, perhaps the actual confirmation is a quicker way of getting to the answer, in addition to assessing the quality of the internal control system.
Thank you. Bob Deasy?
Yeah, I'd just like to offer that I think in our view there shouldn't be absolute requirements, even should considers, because of the variability that we've all talked about here today. One of the discussion points we had too is that if confirmation is perceived to be of a particular value, that perhaps it ought to be the use of confirmations ought to be discussed in your auditor's response to risk of material misstatement and focus this standard on what the confirmation process is if you decide to use confirmation.
Thank you. Sam Renzilla?
I agree with Bob. A requirement to should consider basically drives the auditor to document all the things it thought about and didn't do. And it seems to me what we ought to be focused on is the risk assessment and what you did do, and documenting your risk, and how you responded to that risk. So I would not be in favor of a requirement to should consider, because it just, again, leads to documentation around what you decided you didn't need to do.
Thank you. Any other comments? Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. I think I'd like the requirement in that I think we've had some recent events where the cash that the company had said existed did not exist, or the investments the company said they had did not exist. So I think there's some expectation out there that one efficient way to get some audit evidence about the existence of those cash balances and investments is through a confirmation. So I think there is some expectation by some investors that confirmations are being sent out in those areas. So I think I would support the requirement.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, now we'll talk about reliability of confirmation responses. The standard requires the auditor to evaluate the reliability of confirmation responses and alternative procedures as part of the auditor's overall evaluation of confirmation procedures. The standard acknowledges that there may be situations in which the confirming party responds to a confirmation request other than in written communication mailed to the auditor. When these responses are received, additional evidence may be required to support their validity. For example, a facsimile response involves risk because of the difficulty of ascertaining the source of the response. As discussed previously, banks and other businesses may hire third parties to respond to confirmation requests on their behalf. If a system or process that facilitates confirmation between the auditor and the confirming party is in place, and if the auditor plans to rely on that system or process, another auditor's report on that system or process may assist the auditor in assessing the design and operating effectiveness of the electronic and manual controls that address the reliability of the information being confirmed. This leads me to my next question. What factors should the auditor consider when evaluating the reliability of confirmation responses in paper, electronic, or other form? Joe Crisello?
I think we've hit on a lot of this already in some of our earlier discussion. You know, who's responding would certainly be a factor. One of the things that's not in your discussion paper, and again, I'm not even fully convinced it needs to be in a standard, but it's, you know, I want to at least throw it out. One of the things that I think it's important to think about, I know when I cover confirmations in class, is if you get back the confirmation requests and they're riddled with exceptions, that probably tells you something, if nothing else, about internal control over financial reporting, at least potentially. But the other extreme, I think, is maybe just as dangerous, right? The other extreme is you send out a lot of confirmation requests, and they all come back perfect.
Yeah.
And so, again, I don't know how you put that in a standard exactly. You know, I'd have to think that through a lot more than I have, you know, can quickly do here. But I think that's an issue. And I think sometimes in doing audits, there's a lot of time pressure. And you know, again, it gets to the overriding importance that can never be emphasized too much of professional skepticism. And it just underlies everything auditors do.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay.
Maybe I'll just... We already have something. I was just wondering what the objective of this is, because there's already something in the standard that addresses this. Not to be too, but AU 9330 talks about this already. So I was just wondering, what is it we're trying to accomplish here
that we don't already have? Because there's a standard that we need to go through today on this. So I was just trying to understand that better and what problem we're trying to solve.
Well, you're right. I mean, the standard does have language about assessing the reliability. The question is, does there need to be additional information? What factors should be considered? The other thing is AU 9330 technically isn't a PCAOB standard because it was issued after April 2003 when we adopted our standards.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that nuance, because it's actually a very good principles-based standard, to Joe's point. It goes through the principles and the thought process you should go through in this instance. So I'd encourage you to consider it. It's pretty well written.
We're definitely considering it as we go through the process, but yeah, that's part of it. It addresses some things that the original standard didn't. We haven't adopted it. Any other? Sam Renzilla?
I was just going to help Vin out. I think what he was telling
you. Well, thanks, Sam.
Huh? I'm sorry?
Just thanking you.
You gotcha. I think the answer to your question is actually you can find some very good evidence and standard setting both at the ASB level and at the IAASB level with respect to this question.
Thanks, Sam. Ben, did you have anything else you wanted to know? Any other comments? Okay, now let's talk about situations when management requests that the auditor not confirm certain accounts. The standard does not specifically address such situations or procedures that the auditor might perform when faced with these situations. Therefore, what procedures should the auditor be required to perform to address situations in which management requests that the auditor not confirm accounts? Galen Hansen?
I think the existing guidance, as was just mentioned, I think there's a lot of information already there that there should be heightened skepticism in this situation, and you start with discussing with the officers of the company as to the rational reasons and evaluate the legitimacy of those reasons. However, and depending on the significance and the materiality, I would think that this might be one of those instances where consideration of a discussion with an audit committee chair, used sparingly, but this is one of those times when I think you would might want to exercise that option.
Thank you. Shelley Stein?
As an auditor, I think this is one of those situations where my first reaction would be to run like the wind. We talk about the quality of audits. We talk about documentation. And now we've got management saying, well, please don't confirm this. So my skepticism is going straight up immediately with the request. And there are very limited circumstances that I can imagine where that would happen. And I think that you've got to be very careful about that. Doesn't mean there might not be a legitimate one somewhere, but boy, that ought to be a rare situation.
Thank you. Damon Silvers?
I'm just curious if members of the group who do this more day-to-day than I do could explain any instances they know of where this kind of request would be legitimate. I mean, I can kind of imagine maybe some circumstances, but I'm just curious if anyone's ever actually had one.
So there's a couple of people down there. Hal Schroeder?
Sorry, in my auditing days, I actually did when involving litigation. It was a sensitive issue, and you already knew it was in litigation or about to go in litigation. We were asked not to confirm and speak with the attorney. So, yeah, I could come up with one or two.
No, not at all.
What was the matter was being litigated, and so you were not I'm not sure how I connect the notion that there was litigation with what the nature of the matter was.
The client, as I recall, this is a few years ago, the client was very sensitive to any exchange of information between itself and the other party because it may go into litigation. They just didn't want any more documentation. They had what they wanted, and they were going to litigate it, and they just didn't want to. They were attempting, if I recall, they were attempting to settle it out of court, but it was very likely to go to court, and so they asked for us not to confirm it.
Galen, did you have a comment?
I was going to say basically the same thing. I've had those instances that I've had to deal with.
Hal Schroeder?
Sorry, I did have another comment. Very much like Galen, I sit on a board of an insurance company, and I'm on the audit committee. If we're not confirming something that would normally be confirmed, I would certainly want to know about it. So I would expect it to be a requirement that they actually communicate that.
Thank you. Okay, Ted White.
I like the suggestion that this possibly be a communication back to the audit committee chair. The other thing I was wondering was whether your language could either suggest or require that the auditor reopen their risk assessment and address this issue specifically. I suspect if this is something that they knew up front, that the risk assessment would be quite a bit different going into the audit, and this would materially change that, or should, and that in most instances it's probably something that's going to raise some big red flags. And that at least then, because what I think you need is a mechanism to ensure that it's dealt with, right? That.
Thank you, Ted. Actually, I believe it's ISO 505 has slightly different wording, but they do encourage the auditor to consider the effect of any request like that on a risk assessment, and including risk of fraud. So it's one of the things we've been discussing. I think Bob Dacey was next.
In answer to the question, we thought the procedures outlined in ISO 505, in fact, which were pretty similar to the ones you have in your document, were appropriate procedures in the circumstances.
Thank you. Damon Silvers?
It seems to me that, particularly based on the responses I got to my earlier question, that my intuition about this, which is that this is a very unusual phenomenon when this is a legitimate matter. And that even as, for example, in the litigation arena, right, if there's an account that is subject to litigation, it strikes me that the auditor unavoidably, that's an obviously an account where somebody disagrees with what the preparer is characterizing, how the preparer is characterizing that account. And I think that the fact that the preparer is uncomfortable with that, with a third party like the auditor getting into that, is kind of too bad. The in relation to what the auditor's obligations need to be in that circumstance. I mean, I can imagine a circumstance, for example, where law enforcement is involved, where it would clearly be inappropriate to say tip off someone that law enforcement, you know, you could be in a situation where that kind of extreme thing might make sense, but it seems extraordinarily rare to me. And obviously, and I very much support the notion that there ought to be kind of a presumption that when that occurs, that the auditor needs to be talking to the audit committee to make sure that that there's really a justification for this, and that the PCAOB's guidance and standards in this area need to really kind of ensure that this is a very rarely accepted proposition. I want to go from that though to a broader comment about the discussion thus far, which is that it's not clear to me how explicit, you know, the issue I think Joe Carcel talked about professional skepticism. The question of how much you wish to specify and guide professional skepticism in the drafting of your standards, particularly this area or others, is one that it's, I think, a subtle judgment. It strikes me, for example, that when you talk about different forms of confirmation, that
There are obviously implications to certain to the prevalence of certain types of forms of confirmation, that there are that there's a sliding scale with faxes, that some faxes are pretty much no different from a letter, and other faxes are a lot different from a letter. How much do you want to get into that? And I think that one of the questions that the board might want to consider is the lessons that it has from its inspections, as to whether there is kind of whether there is pretty well established and understood practice in this area, such that that type of guidance is not really necessary, or whether there is not, or whether there seems to be a willingness within the profession, within the firms that do the predominant amount of public company auditing, to kind of just accept anything, to not be skeptical in these areas, and whether therefore some more detailed guidance needs to be had. I don't know the answer, but I assume you all might be able to figure that out.
Thank you. Jim Cox?
I was just wondering about somewhat more of maybe formulaic response here, and think about this as being in the category of a limitation on the scope of the audit, and if material, then the way you normally deal with that question is to see if there's other ways. But for example, litigation situation, I'm not asking how you handled it, but it come to my mind that you may want to think about other ways of getting at that, including, you know, having conversations you can with the counsel for the audit client to get some review about what the exposure is there, and then figure out what the right, but to figure out some way to overcome it. But if you can't overcome it, then I would think that it's appropriate to see this as a limitation on scope, and that the implications of that depends on the materiality of the limitation.
Thank you. Randy Fletcher?
Yeah, I was just going to try to add to Damon's question and Hal's response. I think, Professor Cox, to your point, I mean, we look at confirmation in terms of whether it'd be effective at getting evidence. And if you went to management and they said, don't confirm that account because they may not agree with the balance, I would agree that's a red flag, and I think you'd probably want to direct your attention there. If they said this has been in litigation for 3 years, I think you'd say, well, there's no sense mailing a confirmation to the customer. Instead, I think you'd go to the process of confirming and evaluating responses from outside counsel or in-house counsel to decide what that meant from an accounting standpoint, and not a confirmation that you just knew was of no value and, in fact, could affect their legal strategy. So I don't think it's a matter of you just don't want to do it because it's a problem, and it's a matter of there's a more effective way to get to the answer for something that's in litigation. If they just said, don't mail that when we think they may not agree, I would think that would certainly draw your attention to it.
Thank you. Joe Casella?
I think just about everybody in this room is on board that, except for the litigation situation, it'd be very unusual circumstances where a request by management not to send a confirmation when the auditor feels it's appropriate would be honored without it being viewed at least as a scope limitation. But I think the board runs the risk if they're completely silent in this area, because unfortunately the people in this room are not the ones who are likely to have been involved with problematic behavior, or they wouldn't be in the room. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that ZBEST, which was one of the largest frauds, you know, certainly at the time it happened, was essentially this issue. The auditors wanted to send confirmation to the building restoration projects, and they were convinced that that was going to be problematic from a client perspective, and they didn't do it. More recently, I would refer interested readers to the Breeden report on the WorldCom fraud, where although this wasn't a confirmation issue, the firm, and it was a large firm, I won't mention it by name, wanted to do a certain work in the United Kingdom, and were told that there were reasons why management did not want that done, and a good bit of the fraud was seated in the accounts in that subsidiary. So I think we should not lose sight of those issues.
Thanks, Joe. Ben Coleman?
As the specific question, I repeat what other people have said. The ISO 505 is a pretty good outline again, so it sounds to me like I think we've got the solution here, and a pretty good, again, principles-based procedures that would solve it. I was going to take a shot at answering Damon's broader question, because I'm struck by a similar type of reaction when you go to audit confirmations, and it's as if we're having a conversation a little bit in a vacuum. And, you know, there is something called a risk assessment. You've got assertions, and audit confirmations is one element of dealing with the assertions in the risk assessment. And to be too prescriptive in any one of these actually could have, you know, an inverse effect. It could actually be a negative. We really should be up a level, as you were just talking about, of what is the risk assessment, what are the assertions, how do you use confirmations in at the right time, and there's a time and a place for them, and quite frankly, there's times where this is not the best solution, and to be able to have judgment around that to make sure that we're very outcome-driven against those assertions. Similarly, with the audit committee communications, it's come up a number of times already today, there is a standard on audit committee communications of what needs to be given to the audit committee, and you would hope that in certain situations like this, if it really raised to that level, it would fit into that standard. And so, you know, it came up this morning on concurring partner reviews, it's come up here. You know, there is a standard there. It's actually a pretty good principle standard of what are the types of things that need to go to an audit committee. And instead of putting it individually in a standard, if we think that there is something where that could be, that communication needs to get better, then I'd encourage you to go back and look at that standard of what those communications are and make sure that it is covering, you know, what we believe broadly needs to get to an audit committee.
Thanks, Ben. Hal Schroeder?
I just wanted to follow up, Professor, we did handle it through litigation letter, so, and I think Randy was our independent partner that year, so. actually, he may have been, I'm not certain, but I just don't want to go too far down the path of saying if a client, if the company says, I don't want you to confirm this and here are the reasons why, that we immediately, it just throws up all sorts of red flags and it's the end of the world. Maybe I had a lot of unusual situations, but I had a shipping company that sent crates over and they wouldn't allow me to confirm it. It went to a hot spot in the world. We knew where the ship went. We knew what was in the crates. It happened to be an airstrip. No one was going to accept or sign a piece of paper that said, yes, they received a U.S.-grade military airstrip in that region of the world. They just weren't going to say that. And so we had to come back with alternative procedures. And as I look around the table and know what some of your companies do, I've got to envision that you find yourselves quite often in those situations, and you've got processes and procedures to handle that. So I'm concerned that if we write this too restrictive, that, you know, the end of the world has come, this is a scope limitation, there are going to be a lot of companies that can't be audited, which will create a whole new set of problems. So I can think of several in my own situation, and just looking around the table, I know that there are a few more ideas out there that I just don't want to go too far down that path.
Thank you. Sam Renzilla.
Well, Hal, I can understand why you left Ernst & Young based on that client portfolio. and the fact that Fletchall was your independent reviewer. Because I was getting ready to say, at least in my experience, what we're talking about here is a very unusual circumstance where management would come and say, I don't want you to confirm something. At least my experience, and I think I can speak for my firm, this is not a burning issue. I would agree, though, that when management does come and request it, the ISA 505 factors are the things you can, and in the most extreme circumstance, after you've plowed your way through all the issue, I think there is a possibility that you could find yourself in a scope limitation. But again, that would be a very extreme circumstance, and honestly, this is not a prevalent auditing issue, at least from my experience. Now, maybe your inspection results say different, but I think we're talking about, you know, sort of Halley's Comet here.
Yeah, I don't believe it's a major issue in inspections either. So, Damon Silvers.
I mean, in a way, just as I said earlier, I find this more interesting as a window into some larger things than perhaps as something that hopefully doesn't happen in every day and in every engagement. I'm particularly interested in responding to the comment, and I'm afraid I I think you're, I don't, I know you're, the person was talking about sending airstrips in unmarked containers. which I think opens up a whole different kind of thing. I'll reiterate this. To the extent that Haley's comment comes along, I like the board solution best because I think it reemphasizes where really the client relationship ought to run. And I think that, there is a way in which these kinds of things raise, really, really large problems are generally kind of surfaced at first by something like the request not to get a confirmation. It's the sort of thing like it's an akin to an ethics waiver, thinking back to the distant past of the Enron matter. Right? It's akin to an ethics waiver. There may be reasons to grant ethics waivers, but boy, you know, the request often signals something. And I think that the standard ought to be written with that sort of thing in mind, and I think it will have a salutary effect, meaning a sort of a default of going to the board. I think will make management think again before asking. And I think that's a good idea because then you don't necessarily put so much weight on the manager auditor relationship. That way, but now I want to turn to this business about airstrips because I think that raises a much broader issue. Auditing is not simple. There are issues that an examination of the accounts can raise other issues. I think there is some obligation on the auditor to do something. If in the course of confirmations you discover that your client is bribing foreign officials. Right, which is a violation, which is a felony in the United States. And I can easily imagine in the course of enterprises like shipping airstrips to hot zones that someone might not want to get a confirmation because, in fact, that would set off a criminal inquiry. And I think that there needs to be some guidance here. One of the issues I think that's very present right now, and in a way I think is under discussion at the G20 as we meet, is the sort of interaction of the financial reporting and governance system with some of these larger issues, and whether or not our financial reporting, public company disclosure, and auditing systems adequately capture the range of risks that are in play in businesses. I apologize for harping on this example, but I think that. This is a window into the fact that auditors may often be told answers which at one level may be plausible, but at another level open up all these other issues that are in fact properly the subject of the audit. Right? Meaning that, for example, if a company is engaged in illegal trade in arms, that might be something that would have to be dealt with in the financial statement in some form or fashion, and if it wasn't, that financial statement might not be accurate. So I think that sort of puts it raises this larger context that's opened up by this Haley's comment type issue.
Thank you, Damon. Does anybody else want to comment? Okay. Now, our last topic on confirmations involves disclaimers and restrictive language, including on confirmation responses. Examples of such language include that the information is not guaranteed to be accurate nor current and may be a matter of opinion, and the confirming party does not accept any responsibility for errors and omissions. The standard does not specifically address the use of disclaimers and restrictive language by confirming parties, which leads me to my last question. Should the auditor be required to perform procedures to evaluate the effect of disclaimers and restrictive language on confirmation responses? If so, what procedures should an auditor be required to perform in evaluating such disclaimers or restrictive language?
Uh,
Joe Grisello.
I thought your list on page 8 was a good list. And certainly tease up the discussion nicely. I guess from my point of view, disclaimers designed to solely limit legal liability from the perspective of who responds, not from the auditor's perspective, but from the perspective of who responds, are probably okay. And you can't force these parties to respond to confirmations. This is a voluntary action. However, disclaimers that call into question the accuracy of the response, to me, weakens the audit evidence provided. So to me, if I looked at what you had on page 8, there were two types there. One was really more of, we're not going to take legal liability by choosing to voluntarily help you. I'm not sure if that is a big issue. On the other hand, some of the others said, we're not even sure this information is right. That, to me, is very different.
So, Joe, would you be recommending that the auditor just document that thought process, that this disclaimer really doesn't have much of any effect on the audit evidence versus the other type?
Yeah, I'm sensitive to the people who practice every day, and you know, there's obviously been a lot of concerns raised this morning about excessive documentation burden. So I think that's fair, and I think that's valid, but I think I think that's something you could document in one or two sentences.
Hal Schroeder?
This is more of a question. It may be more addressed to the SEC observers, but if you're dealing with public companies that you're trying to confirm things with, can there be some type of requirement placed upon any SEC registrant?
It's an interesting question. I think we need to talk to the lawyers, because for once, the SEC doesn't have lawyers present. So you're asking two accountants that question. It's something we can take back. The problem is it would only deal with a certain population of the universe. I mean, confirmations go out to non-public companies all the time, and so you would be limiting it in that manner. I think we'd have to think about whether we could bring action under a securities law violation that you've. We need to think through it, and that's something we can certainly ask.
Yeah, but I'm thinking that A would cover the bulk of the assets that are being audited out there, at least the significant assets. And the second point is, as I read through, and I agree, these were very good examples, and they look very similar to what I recall seeing in various confirmations. These would be, to Professor's comment earlier, to me, these would be scope limitations, which really presents a real problem from an audit perspective. And so what you do is you start to get more and more of this type of response, and your efficiency of auditing, if not the whole audit process, starts to collapse, which to me is an SEC issue.
Agree. And, I think one thing we'd need to consider, though, is the repercussions to preparers. If we now have the security law that says if you confirm something and it's not accurate, you're going to be held accountable from a legal standpoint. I can imagine what the disclaimers are now going to appear, and we're going to be back, and can I rely on this confirmation, because I received the cash confirmation back that has 10 pages of disclaimers. And so, I think that's something we need to think about, and it's something we can certainly take back to our people.
Thanks, Paul, for answering that. Okay, Randy Fletchall?
I was just going to add, in a similar vein, I think Wayne Collins said earlier, a long time ago, that we are seeing an increase in response to, say, from banks that are just filled with disclaimers. And I think an auditor does have to look at those from a standpoint of, some you can kind of ignore, others look like they might affect the reliability of the evidence, and you can't ignore those. But I think we find ourselves slugging those out one by one, engagement by engagement, with a particular institution. And I think if there was some collective way to deal with these, so whether it's the PCOB or, how suggested, the SEC, some way to deal with, what would be an appropriate caveat or limiting language in a confirmation, what would be inappropriate, and try to get these done right the first time, it really would save a lot of time and effort.
Thank you. Wayne Collins?
On the suggestion that the SEC consider ways to impose a requirement on issuers. It really goes beyond that, too, because you've got many of these do come from financial institutions that are not issuers. And so you look at the bank regulators for possibly doing this kind of a thing. And I thought there was something in Sarbanes-Oxley or the outgrowth of that which basically made it unlawful to lie to auditors. And I think that's probably the seeds for a lot of what's happening now. So there is an interplay here.
Thanks, Wayne. That's my understanding, too. Gary Kaperk?
Actually, Wayne hit my point. I think one of the 59 sections of the SOX Act there is about misrepresentation to auditors. And when it first came out 5 or 6 years ago, there was a flurry of, in the legal community, advice their clients, don't answer if you don't have to.
Wayne Carnell.
Thank you. Paul and I were actually just chatting. I can't recall the specifics, but there was actually an enforcement case against a company where they actually did lie on their confirmations. I think it was actually involving a Japanese subsidiary where there was massive collusion among all these companies all lying on their confirmations, and the commission did actually take action against that company. Yeah, I'll try to find the specifics.
Thank you, Wayne. Ian Dingwall.
Yeah, I was just going to say the confirmations that I see that typically make me a little crazy is the ones that say, to the best of my knowledge and belief. And you have no idea who signed that thing.
They were drafted by a lawyer.
Yeah. Actually, you're quite right about that. Probably a bank of lawyers. But I've always wondered what to make out of that. And it seemed to me that if I was an auditor getting something, it says, to the best of my knowledge and belief, I'd wonder who that person was and in what capacity was that person signing. And frankly, the other thing that happens oftentimes with these is there's a stamp. It's not even a signature. It's just a stamp. It was stamped by whoever had the stamp that day.
Thank you. Gary?
Just building on his last comment, the best of my knowledge and belief, that's in the rep letters today from manager. Right on page one, I mean, so you got the issue elsewhere. And here's from people who actually are supposed to know what's going on inside the accounts of the company. And it's the first paragraph almost of a standard rep letter.
Thank you. Any other comments? Gail Hansen.
I just want to be sure we don't lose sight of the fact that responding to confirmations is voluntary. And so we get them in our office, and this gentleman was right. Who signs them is a big question. Are they come in, and then our mailroom, think of the expertise here, has to figure out who they go to. And so if you don't, and I think it behooves you to ask your client, who is the best, you know, is it written to the accounting department, the legal department, how to best address those confirmations? Because when it gets to my mailroom, it's up for grabs.
Doug Anderson.
I was just going to add a side point. Maybe now's the right time to do it. I remember, I don't have the quotes from the past, some past research, that sometimes auditors can put too much reliance on confirmations. And they're not always accurate. And I think the guidance, whatever it has to make sure we understand the limitations, whether it's a stamp, whether it's somebody who's in the mailroom signing them, or whatever else it is, they're not as perfect and as reliable as sometimes I think auditors would hope they were.
Thank you. Warren Malkus.
I think we've just about killed this one, but... I think that from all of the comments that you've heard is that there's not a lot of confidence in the confirmation process itself. Not only is there a low response rate, but then you have those that have been received, confirmations that have been received have disclaimers. So I've always been of the belief that the confirmations that you actually do receive and don't have a disclaimer on them, maybe they should have. In other words, there's not much left that you have that you can rely on if you only use the confirmation process. So going back to a previous question, I think that what should be mandatory is the fact that that alternative procedures should be in place, audit procedures should be in place to give the auditor the confidence. I mean, you'll be back to the due professional care and the evidential matter that's required to reach a conclusion on those assets, liabilities, whatever it is that you're trying to confirm.
Any other comments? Okay, thank you very much, and I'll turn it back over to Jennifer.
Okay, thanks, Dee. We're going to go ahead and break for lunch. Just a couple logistical issues. One, as I had mentioned this morning, we have copies available of what the FASB issued this morning, or made publicly available. So those are back at the registration desk. So please pick that up. Also, lunch is provided for SAG members, observers, and PCOB staff, and that'll be in rooms A, B, and C, which is out here to your right. For other members of the public, you are on your own, but we will be resuming at 1:15. And at that point, we'll start with the discussion of emerging issues. Okay, thanks.